in the Neapolitan home between 1400 and 1600, which forms one-ninth of a much bigger project, a near-sea-funded project called the Domestic Devotions, the Place of Piety, in the Italian Renaissance home between 1400 and 1600. So much has been investigated for the more public aspect of the Italian religiosity. And this is due to the fact that up to the 1990s, scholarly attention has been given to the historical view that Catholics were like a homogeneous group, an entity, then in unison would celebrate canonical feast days, go to church, pilgrimages, and processions, as exemplified by Gentile Bellini's painting of the procession of the relic of the True Cross in Piazza San Marco, painted in 1496. All this seems to be at the opposite end of the popular iconography for the Protestant devout, often depicted within the four walls of his or her home. This room, for instance, is cluttered with objects of piety, from biblical panels on the walls to the tiles of the wood burner and to the general sense of such devout family gathering. Recent scholarship seems more interested in seeking evidence of the devotion of individual Catholics. So the initial questions of my PhD rise right from this point. How would early Neapolitan pray when they were not in church? And how can we access their private realm and the materiality of their domestic religious objects? Investigating the materiality of devotion will allow a better understanding of those complex interactions between objects and people that shaped the individual's piety. I will be looking for traces of domestic stuff in contemporary paintings, inventories, and first-hand testimonies. Unfortunately, for the historian in search of the material culture of piety, there are very few paintings that depict Italian domestic scenes, such as this one, but not, and simultaneously give insights into the devotional images and objects that must have cluttered the Renaissance home. An ideal finding for Naples would be something like this. It's a Dream of Saint Ursula painted by Vittore Carpaccio in 1495. The devotional painting on the wall with the candle and the holy water stand, devotional books, a choral string of Paternoster, all together in the saint's bedchamber. But surely the middle Italian citizen would not have owned such an array of devotional objects. So which things worked for the middle Italian devout of the 15th and 16th century? Amongst the many devotional props produced for the Renaissance Italian home, today I would like to explore the materiality of the rosary and to show how its very materiality is vital for a better understanding of what devout meant for an early modern Catholic. The rosary, rosario, or rose garden, where the Hail Mary is offered like flowers to the Virgin. It is often associated with the holding and rubbing of the beads that the Virgin gave to St. Dominic, as shown in this grand, colorful painting by Lorenzo Lotto in Le Marche. One of the distinctive features of the rosary was the emphasis on repetition. The devout would say no fewer than 150 Hail Marys or Aves. These were divided into three sets of 50 and recited orally in groups of 10, punctuated by an Our Father or Pater Noster. Although it is impossible to know precisely when practitioners of the rosary first began to employ beads, it is evident that this tangible tool, which would have assisted in the counting of prayers, was borrowed from the Islamic prayer beads, which supported Muslim repetitive chants. So let's look first at inventories. What can be found? The rosary is one kind of religious artifact that often turns up in inventories across Italy from the 15th century onward. Archival findings in Le Marche are proving really exciting for what Naples may be holding for me. For example, in Tolentino, a 1525 post-mortem inventory of a bachelor named Jacobi di Michelonibus reveals that he owned a rosary made of black amber and a rosary made of pieces of 109 corals. These are Amber Paternosters in Naples, and there are Paternosters and not rosaries. As my understanding of the difference between a rosary and a Paternoster is that the rosary is often a closed and full circle group of beads, resembling the crown of flowers associated with the rose garden of the Virgin, whereas the Paternoster was strongly shown in this photograph. However, I don't think that the physical difference between a rosary and a Paternoster was only mirrored in inventories. Another example is from a 1461 inventory of Lorenzo Di Marco, a spice seller from Recanati, who, together with many tools to make rosaries as part of his trade, left to his son 11 bunches of blackened glass Paternosters, a small box of Paternoster beads, and another box with white, red, and varied colors Paternosters. Here's another example of what crystal Paternosters may have looked like, and an example of a great array of colors and materials. At the back is coral, and then at the front there are pearls and semi-precious stones. So 15th and 16th century inventories clearly attest to the availability of a rich array of beads made of precious stones, corals, pearls, enamels, gold, as well as transparent and colored glass, magnets, amber, or copper. In 1475, a certain Filippo da Verrazzano, a Roman trader mainly in fine cloth, also figures as importer of miscellaneous consignments such as 2,800 enamel rosaries, or Paternostri de Smalto. Here is an example of what he could have meant for enamel rosaries. This is part of a rosary made of gilded copper and enamel beads that I have recently seen at the Cleveland Museum of Art, Ohio. But more about this example in a few minutes. For now, I would like to carry on with what published and unpublished postmortem and dowry inventories can tell about rosaries and Paternosters. They can tell, for example, of more existing sizes and materials, so much that rosaries could suit a range of tastes and budgets and become high-spec objects. Coral from the Mediterranean was in competition with amber from the Baltic or German chalcedony. Meanwhile, in the south of Italy, via Naples, the New World Osso Leonato, or Osso di Spagna, became popular. These beads were made from the stones of a fruit that grew on plants known by European travelers as Paternoster trees. Ramusio, who died in Venice in 1554, wrote the first geography treatise, and he dedicated a section to the Paternoster trees found in the Spanish island of Haiti. He describes the fruits, and the stone of the fruit is black. Dry it under the sun and they look like bones. Make holes and use them as Paternosters, like the ones made of ebony, but they are lighter and shinier and they don't break as easily as the ebony ones. Another possible refinement was the emission of fragrance, Paternostri de profumo. May have referred to rosaries made of paste created with compressed ambergris or musk, a method described in a 16th century South Italian recipe book by a perfume maker from Naples. In the last sentence, he instructs the reader that once the paste from ambergris is made, you can make Paternosters or balls or any other shape that you wish. Here we've got some compressed ambergris balls and an enameled copper hip chain that Evelyn Welch suggests it was filled with such perfume balls. In this other portrait, Lucrezia Panciatichi, a Florentine aristocrat, is wearing an example of a hip chain made this time of what look like perfume balls alternated to stone beads. And the perfume ball I put at the top is an example that is possibly German from the DNA, but it's still undecided. So although secular objects, it doesn't take a great effort to imagine these same perfume balls used as praying beads. So were rosaries, and by extension all other kinds of devotional objects, just another form of worldly goods, but disguised as objects of piety? After all, the main reason why Paternoster beads appear so consistently in household inventories, is because they had a clear monetary value. There is no doubt about the beauty of the examples seen so far. The recurrence of rosaries and Paternoster beads in sumptuary loads all over Italy might also lead us to dismiss these accessories as modish indicators of style and status, rather than meaningful objects of devotion. That the corona could be an expensive item of beauty and fashion is beyond dispute, but was beauty opposed to piety? Two final examples will hopefully show that the rosary's beauty and its materiality may have reinforced its spiritual value and will help us to better understand what devotion meant for an early Italian Catholic. A portrait at the National Gallery in London, attributed to Bartolomeo Veneto and dated to the first decade of the 16th century, depicts a beautiful young woman with dark hair and pale skin wearing a long and ostentatious necklace. There is no doubting the wealth and status of the woman in the portrait. She's elegantly dressed and she wears a delicate golden diadem fashioned in the form of a leafy branch. Her necklace, however, is more than it at first seems. Closer inspection reveals that the beads that ornament her ample cleavage are in fact hexagonal enamel copper rosary beads, ornamented with the symbols of Christ's passion. The painter did not simply hint at the devotional purpose of the beads by reference to some generic type of rosary. He clearly wanted the onlooker to grasp their significance more fully by faithfully reproducing a specific set of prayer beads, presumably owned by the sitter. Remarkably, beads closely comparable to those depicted in the Veneto portrait survive in museums in Berlin, Cleveland, New York, and Rome. And by examining these examples, it is possible to gain a better sense of what such devotional adornments might have looked and felt like. Let us begin in Berlin. Here there are 8 beads, made of what the curators insist saying being bronze, but I think is gilt copper, with champlevé enamels, all hexagonal. The beads are linked together by late metal hooks rather than strung. And in the photo was sent, we can see facets with the symbols of Christ's passion, the ladder, the pliers, and the cross, as well as inscriptions such as Rex and IHS. From around the turn of the century, rosaries were being crafted in response to the growing Christocentric impulse in prayer reformation devotion, and this set seems to have answered to such devotional impulses. In its entirety, the rosary may well have been as long as the necklace worn by the woman in the portrait. The beauty of the Berlin beads derives both from its material and its ornamentation. Copper gives the beads luminosity, which is enhanced by the enameling. The distinctive hexagonal shape of the beads presented the jeweler with multiple facets on which to lavish his decorative arts. Traces of red, white, and dark green pigments are all that remains of what were probably colorful floral motifs. These were just a twist away from verbal inscriptions, but compared with the beads worn by the girl in the portrait, the similarities are striking. There are the same pliers, ladder, and cross. So let's ponder for a moment on this exceptional comparison while we move to the medieval art collection in Cleveland, where I have just come from after seeing this. 15 beads remain, made of gilt copper with champlevé enamels. Of these, 13 are small and hexagonal, and 2 are large and olive-shaped. As big and small beads survive, we can assume that the rosary's owner would have worked through the smaller beads while reciting the Ave, the larger beads were the cue to pray the Paternoster. As it survives, this rosary consists of one complete set of 10 Ave Marias and a Paternoster. Almost all the beads carry inscriptions. Here are some examples that signaled the Hail Mary, Ave and Maria. The 2 bigger beads are decorated with flowers, flanked by green foliate motifs on each segment of the olive form. The recurrence of floral designs alongside the words of the Ave Maria made this ornate and luxurious object a veritable rose garden of prayer to the Virgin. But there are also Christocentric inscriptions, as Rex and IHS. Many are the similarities between the Berlin and the Cleveland set, and many are the questions that rise from a comparison. Were these the enamel rosaries mentioned in archival inventories? Were such elite devotional objects props made in series? Was owning these rosaries really for devotional purposes? The hexagonal enamel beads clearly illustrate how a rosary might be laden with decoration, symbolism, and meaning. But we cannot pretend that these examples were typical of consumers at all levels of society. Of course, it was far more common for a rosary to be a cheap and plain affair made of wood, bone, or paste. But whatever the material, a familiar set of rosary beads held during the repetitive chanting of the Ave and Paternoster assisted their owner in leaving the world behind. And what about the girl in the painting and her relationship with the beads? Was wearing the necklace an act of devotion? I find it hard to imagine the girl constantly reciting the rosary, but it may be that while playing with the necklace and feeling the enamel letters and symbols on the beads, she was suddenly reminded of her faith and belief. trying to answer the question on whether owning this kind of rosaries propped piety showed an unmissable paradox. The very materiality of those of the rosary served to take the devotee out of the material realm. Signs of usage can be detected on the prayer beads we have seen. In the case of the Cleveland Rosary, the enamel decorations and inscriptions of the smaller beads are well preserved, while the enamels on the bigger beads have almost completely disappeared. This is consistent with the wear caused by the devotee's fingers rubbing the smooth shape of the round bead, an action probably discouraged by the angular edges of the smaller hexagonal ones. A telling example of beautiful rosaries in use can be found in the painting of the Miracle of the True Cross at the Bridge of San Lorenzo by Giovanni Bellini, painted about 1500. The canvas tells the story of a miracle that happened during the yearly procession of the True Cross from the Scuola Grande of San Giovanni Evangelista through the city of Venice. On this occasion, the relic fell into the canal, and despite numerous attempts to save the precious fragment of the cross, only the guardian of the Scuola, who was the custodian of the holy relic, managed to rescue it. The detailed painting shows the banks of the canal busy with onlookers, all of all classes, gawping at the scene. But a closer look reveals that some of the aristocratic women in the bottom left-hand corner of the painting are holding their rosaries with their fingertips and have their lips slightly parted, caught in the act of reciting the rosary for the recovery of the relic. The noble woman in the foreground is thought to be Caterina Cornaro, Queen of Cyprus, who is using a rosary of golden pearls, or maybe gilt copper. The young girl beside her is holding a rosary made of black beads, possibly amber, and the woman on the other side is holding a coral one. The relationship between piety and vanity is delicately suspended in this snapshot image. It would be easy to dismiss these objects as the sort of stuff that only the Venetian upper classes would indulge with. But those familiar with the story of the miracle would have understood the power of those lovely beads. So from pearls, amber and coral to wood and paternosters that grew on tree, worn on the breast or held in the hands, from inventories, paintings and examples, all of this seems to suggest that during the Renaissance, rosaries were highly tactile objects. Their beauty did invite to pray. Their materiality was essential to the spiritual journey of the faithful, and the study of religious materiality is a vital means for gaining access to that individual state of devotion. Thank you.
Okay, so next up we have Eleanor Chan from the History of Art Department here at Cambridge on English cognitive style, material and immaterial, embroidered and or geometric traces of post-Reformation visuality. So do you want to come on up and we'll grab your PowerPoint up.
Okay. Okay. The texture of post-Reformation England can be evocatively described as sumptuously embroidered. Embroidery had been a popular mode of ornamentation sporadically throughout the history of the island nation, but the long period of stability represented by Elizabeth's reign brought about its golden age. The few surviving examples of late Tudor embroidery embody merely a fraction of the decorative form which once covered the bodies, walls, tables, chairs, and books of the post-Reformation world. Generally, this poor survival rate has been attributed to the immense material value of these items. Not only were they often laden with gold and silver thread and spangles, the early modern term for sequins, and gems and pearls, they were also the products of hours of immense skill. These objects were continuously recycled, transformed from clothing into cushion covers, into carpets, until they completely disintegrated. As Susan North states, given this liquidity of clothing in both its whole and its constituent parts, it is miraculous that anything remains from the late 16th or early 17th century. We are also able to catch a glimpse of this highly decorated world by looking at the portraiture of this period, some of which places the sitter in an elaborately furnished setting, and many of which give centre stage to the clothes of the sitters rather than the sitters themselves. The popularity of this material form can provide us with a vital lens into understanding the mentality of the people of post-Reformation England. For a long time, the history of early modern English art has been dominated by theories such as Patrick Collinson's visual anorexia, the belief that that the English Reformation instigated a century-long aversion to the visual,
and the continuing desire to compare the work of English artists and artisans with that of their Italian counterparts. Recent scholarship has gone a long way to refute the concept of visual anorexia and to demonstrate that the art of England, and indeed most of Northern Europe, was not backward or old-fashioned, but rather different. My own work seeks to track the developments which have resulted in abstraction becoming understood as a more explicitly cognitive mode of visualization than figurative imagery. Thus far, this has largely involved tackling the myth of visual anorexia by examining how far English expressions of visuality in this period might be characterized by something deeper, something more psychological, a cognitive style. Traces of this cognitive style can be found not only in what we would now refer to as the art of this period, but also in the material culture of Reformation England, and especially so in the immensely popular embroidered form. Before we plunge into the depths of what, if anything, might constitute embroidered and/or geometric traces of post-Reformation visuality, I'm going to take a moment to address the concept of English cognitive style. Cognitive style is, of course, taken from Michael Baxendahl, and is defined as a stock of patterns, categories, and methods of inference, training in a range of representational conventions, and experience drawn from the environment in what are plausible ways of visualizing what we have incomplete information about. In other words, this is how we are trained to see, both when we are looking and when we are visualizing or representing our environment, both the stock of patterns, categories, and methods of inference through which we perceive and make sense of the world, and the way we translate our perception for others to see. For Baxendahl, cognitive style was both an individual and collective way of seeing. For the present purposes, I'm going to focus on the idea of an inherited, collective cognitive style, transferred from master to apprentice, mother to daughter, father to son. This learned way of seeing, embedded in the habit and bodies of the people of Reformation England, provides a key insight into their material culture. This way of seeing, moreover, was very much of a world still infused with the Aristotelian concept of the hora vacui. Everything emitted an invisible pneuma, meaning that the very air through which people moved and was understood to be thick with the pulsating motion of a thousand objects constantly apprehended by the senses. Michel Jeanneret's description is particularly vivid. These people believe that matter vibrates with a secret life, a diffuse spirit saturates and unites all things. Knowledge encompasses in an unbroken continuity the physical and the spiritual, empirical facts and speculation, reasoning and projectives of the imagination. The concept was, to an extent, coupled with faculty psychology, the theory by which this invisible pneuma moved from the outside world through the fantasia or imagination, the cogitatio or intellect, and finally the memoria, memory, into the internal world and vice versa. And this is illustrated beautifully by Robert Flood's 1619 diagram of the function of the senses, intellect, and imagination. There's a fascinating interplay of reciprocal, reverberating gestures set in motion by these shapes. We're supposed to be able to read this image both inwards and outwards. Surviving embroidered remnants are the products of this worldview. They express the concerns, desires, and beliefs which come with the hora vacui, a world in which everything was entwined, warp and weft, pun very much intended, with each other and with the divine. By thinking through these things, we can gain an unparalleled insight into the way the cognitive style of post-Reformation England was constructed, anchored in its material expression and processes of construction. Embroidery was used as a didactic tool, employed in the formative years of a young lady's education, or the training of a young male or female apprentice affiliated with the worshipful company of broderers. Parallel to the increase in taste for and production of embroidered furnishings and clothing, which exploded across England in the late 16th and early 17th centuries, was an exponential increase in the level of skill demanded of the non-professional embroiderer. It was an important social skill which enmeshed the embroiderer into the fabric of English society. The ability to display such a dazzling level of accomplishment would enhance the appearance of the embroiderer's home and household, thereby manifesting the status of both individual as marriageable or employable entity and the family as a whole. I should mention at this point that very few domestic furnishings are known to have been worked by adult women in the 1600s, but of course this doesn't mean that they weren't. The Great Fire, amongst many other things, could be responsible for the lack of evidence. However, in contemporary accounts, when a woman of status was working, it meant that she was engaged specifically with her needle and thread. In learning this work with needle and thread, young boys and girls were stitching themselves into society and into this grand continuum by which Numa linked microcosm with macrocosm, person to person, object to object, and all to the divine. These processes, moreover, once learned, became subconscious, an effortless recall of the shapes and gestures which make up the tent stitch, the cross stitch, the goblin stitch, and so on. The hand learnt these patterns of movement, and in so doing allowed the mind free movement within the frame of these shapes. In this way, embroidery resembles another didactic process which was being absorbed by grammar school boys and apprentices in a surprising variety of trades in this period, geometry. This is not least for the fact that the foundations of geometry was the point in motion, a conceptual echo of the needle and thread. The post-Reformation English are famed for their refusal to adopt the principles of fixed-point perspective in their painting. Seldom mentioned in even sympathetic accounts of the visual art of this period is the fact that geometry was enthusiastically adopted in many other realms of English life. Gresham College, founded in 1597, provided instruction in divinity, law, medicine, music, rhetoric, astronomy, and geometry for use in trade. Henry Billingsley published the first English translation of Euclid's Geometry in 1570, with a mathematical preface by John Dee, which explicitly stated that it was intended for use by tradespeople. In mastering these learned shapes, merchants, goldsmiths, mint masters, and lawyers assimilated the pattern of geometry into their cognitive style. Geometry, like embroidery, functioned as a framing tool, a lens through which to perceive what Dee referred to as the glass of creation. It was, furthermore, geometry expressed as a language with a two-dimensional, or, as David Evatt called it, paratactic significance, stronger than its illusory three-dimensional manifestation. The fact that both geometry and embroidery were instruments of education means, moreover, that their impact extended beyond the mastering of one single process. In learning to embroider and to use geometrical constructions, girls and boys of Reformation England were assimilating a worldview with every stitch and every line, bound into an intricate web of the invisible pneuma emitted by their surroundings. Understanding of the entire structure of the cosmos was conceived within the very materiality of this period. Thinking with things shaped the perceived reality of God's creation. A case in point is the Bostock sampler, now housed in the V&A. The sampler, the earliest surviving of its kind, is the creation of Jane Bostock and is dated 1598 by its own inscription, which celebrates the birth of Alice Lee, Bostock's cousin, 2 years earlier. You can see it along the top of the pattern bed there. It occupies a transitional stage in the form of the sampler, shifting from the earlier usage within which they served as a reference piece for an experienced embroiderer to a usage more common in the 17th century as an expression of the embroiderer's skill. Vacillating between functions of practice and display, this sampler mediates between the pattern held in the fantasia or imagination and the visual tactile engagement which samples or rehearses externalizing it for expression on a garment or furnishing cover. Its liminality is continuously foregrounded in construction as the needle passes through the linen, inscribing the pattern in material form. It is given both a mental and a physical reality. This is an explicitly didactic item. Imagine how the subtleties of this meaning, a world composed of gobelin, of tent or of satin stitch, would shift when working on a covering for an everyday item of furnishing, or a piece of clothing to be worn whilst moving through this thoroughly ambient environment. When it came to the body, the function of textiles in this period extended far beyond simply covering or decorating, although these were undeniably important. Given the conceptual leakiness of the post-Reformation worldview, all matter vibrating with a secret life, clothing performed a vital interceptive or protecting role. For us today, this notion that illness could be contracted simply through uncovered flesh is extremely alien. However, for the people of late Elizabethan England, it was a powerful and dangerous fact of reality. Susan Vincent has made a compelling argument for an envisioning of the body within which the boundaries between flesh and fabric merged, And indeed, for contemporary support of this theory, we need look no further than Erasmus, for whom clothing was the body's body. The process of embroidery, of putting needle through fabric, was tied to these concerns. It was an endeavour of care. Embroidering a garment was not just to decorate it, but also to thicken its texture, and thus arguably to increase its protective qualities and its ability to maintain the good health or humoral balance of the wearer. Lack of continuous bodily covering could seriously jeopardise far more than simple propriety. In thinking about the process of embroidery, from the rehearsed sampler to the items which would have experienced everyday wear, we can see that the stitched aesthetic went far beyond the question of what was visually or haptically pleasing. It is often tempting to see the intellectual climate of any period as irrevocably divided from its materiality. Through the example of post-Reformation embroidery, however, it is possible to catch a glimpse not only of the contemporary cognitive style, but also of where we might find an intersection between the contemporary intellectual and material culture. There are now many fantastic accounts of geometry and its relationship to sensory perception, such as the works of Dennis Sepper and David Summers. If we follow this argument to its logical extension, these geometrical phantasmata, or sense images, will manifest themselves in the material objects of the post-Reformation period. Therefore, although it is in many ways futile to ask whether these young ladies or apprentices knew anything about faculty psychology or the Aristotelian horror vacui, we can productively think about whether they felt them. English cognitive style was built out of paratactic geometry, which privileged the relationship of elements on the same plane rather than a hierarchy of elements. Embroidery, like geometry, was a mode of this kind of cognition, and one which enmeshed the materiality, the things of this period, into the perceived reality of God's creation.
So, without further ado, we now have Julia Galasso. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm always afraid I'm going to do these really wrong, from the History Department, with Forbidden Finery, the Aims and Targets of Early Modern Genoese Sumptuary Law.
In the afternoon of the 20th of May, 1595, the wife of Gioannettino the cheesemaker was sitting on the doorstep of her house on the Via Macelli di Sosiglia in Genoa. The cheesemaker's wife was sewing a man's silk shirt. Dyed in costly crimson, with gold and silver braids 3 fingers thick, this was a dangerously extravagant item. Why was it dangerous? And how do we know about this incident? The answer to both questions lies in sumptuary law and the records of people breaking it. In this paper, I will be mining these legal documents for clues about the entangled relationship between people, practices, and things, in this case clothing, and the early modern Italian Republic of Genoa. I hope to be able to shed new light on 2 sumptuary assumptions. Firstly, did anyone pay attention to these laws? Because some have argued that no one did, that the laws were effectively a dead letter. I don't think that was the case in Genoa. And secondly, who were the main offenders against it? A lot of the historiography has focused exclusively on elite women. And again, I don't think that's what's going on in Genoa. So I will be concentrating on 2 groups I feel have been left out of the sumptuary story, men and artisans. First things first, though, what is sumptuary law? The origins of sumptuary law can be traced back to ancient Sparta, but they reached their peak in the medieval and early modern periods. They sought to control excess spending on what we might call luxury goods, from expenses for funerals or weddings to different forms of transport. The laws were above all, though, concerned with personal adornments in the form of jewellery, accessories, and clothing. I will be focusing on clothing, and in particular the clothing of Genoa, a maritime republic in the northwest of Italy. Genoa has rather dropped off the historical radar in recent years, but in the early modern period it was populous and prosperous, with bankers who financed the Spanish crown, and a patrician class who could afford portraits of themselves looking like this, by Rubens or Van Dyck. One more background piece of information on Genoa. By some estimates, over 60% of its population were involved in one way or another in the silk trade, from women who unwound the raw silk from cocoons to wealthy noblemen brokering deals to export black silk velvet, a fabric for which the city had an international reputation. Genoa also had some of the longest-lived sumptuary laws in Europe, which were in place from the mid-12th century to the late 18th century. Now, these two things might sound paradoxical. Why would a state be keen to restrict luxury consumption when the livelihoods of such a huge number of its population depended on a luxury fabric? And that's a question I'd like you to keep at the back of your mind as you listen to my paper, because I think it's one of the fundamental tensions of sumptuary law. Why would you try to ban something when so many people depend upon it? Sumptuary laws have been popular with historians of material culture, because we can work backwards from the things being prohibited to the things being used. Indeed, the prohibition of certain things might have the unintended consequence of spawning new things. As Catherine Covesi knows, if silver buttons were banned, silver hooks might become popular. In this sense, the authorities appear to be engaged in a game of fashion whack-a-mole, in which, as soon as one trend is hammered down, a new one springs up to take its place. Why were they doing that? What was the basic point of these seemingly ridiculous laws? Well, those are big questions, and ones I'm not going to attempt to answer in this short paper. I will say, though, that the laws can be seen as a response to a burgeoning and bewildering material culture in early modern Italy. To steal Richard Goldthwaite's famous phrase, perhaps sumptuary laws can be seen as attempts to delineate and delimit the boundaries of the empire of things. In the rest of this paper, though, I will be focusing on the how instead of the why. The laws in action, not in theory. Specifically, I will be looking at the 4 years extant records of people breaking the laws from 1594 to 98, which I'm going to refer to as the charges. These charges were recorded by the sumptuary officers, a band of four men roaming around the city, probably on horseback. They made meticulous notes on anyone they saw contravening the law, including the name of the offender and the date, time, and location of the offence, as well as recording details of the offending item of clothing. They were, in effect, the fashion police. Now, I'm keen to stress the possibilities of these records, of which I'm only going to be able to scratch the surface in this paper. Instead of being a disembodied list of things in the style, say, of an inventory, the detailed records the sumptuary officers produced show us things in motion. These are clothes in use, as opposed to clothes in storage, which makes it easier for us to form connections between things, people, and practices. The officers apprehended people when they were out and about, so we catch glimpses of these forbidden things in a social context. From this, we can begin to build up a spatialised picture of elite sociability, of people moving about the city, flaunting their fine clothes. And I've not got time to consider spatialisation fully here, but it might be something interesting to think about at the end, the location of small things, clothes, and the big thing, the city. Did anyone care about these laws? One of the things that has puzzled historians about sumptuary law was that they continued to be enacted, even though there did not seem to be much evidence of people paying attention to them. In Genoa, as elsewhere, sumptuary laws were frequently reissued, suggesting that the magistrates struggled to remind the public of their edicts. This picture of no one really caring about the laws seems to continue when we leaf through the charges, because there are a huge number of offences. Over this 4-year period, the officers recorded at least 561 contraventions of the law. And I say at least because it seems likely that, especially for the earlier period, there are some gaps in the records. Among this, there are a certain number of repeat offenders. One of the most extensive charges is for a certain Salvaggio de Aste. On the 15th of September 1595, he broke the law on numerous points of dress. Salvaggio de Asti has been seen in the morning in the square of San Siro with an embroidered cap, a silk doublet of many colours with gold buttons on the sleeves, two rings with white stones on his fingers, a jerkin, an embroidered hose in black silk. Despite the admonitions of the officers, however, in 3 days' time, Salvaggio was back in San Siro in exactly the same outfit. Less than a month later, on the 5th of November, he returned to San Siro again, this time wearing a leather jerkin impregnated with musk, in which he made other appearances on the 13th of November and the 14th of November. In August 1596, he's recorded twice back in San Siro, once again wearing an embroidered black silk outfit. Whatever admonitions or fines he may have received clearly did very little to deter Salvaggio from parading his ostentatious attire in his favourite location. His is quite an extreme example, but there are several other repeat offenders who seem similarly unbothered by sumptuary law. Jane Bridgman has argued that moderate fines would not have been much of a deterrent given the initial outlay on the garment. Perfumed leather, silk fabric, embroidery with precious metal threads. These things were all hugely expensive, and wearers such as Salvaggio seemed determined to make the most of their investment, regardless of the sumptuary restrictions. Genoese writer Ansaldo Cebà seems to touch on a similar sort of ostentatious male behaviour in his 1620 commentary on the characters of Theophrastus. In a passage entitled Strolling Through the Square, he describes a particular sort of young Genoese man who, maybe the better to show off his beautiful outfit, he will, when he is wearing breeches a la Spagnola or an embroidered doublet, circulate around the city so sedulously that you can't help bumping into him in church, in the square or on the corner. He'll suddenly appear in front of you, and you needn't even think of leaving until you have admired him from head to toe. Indeed, he will compel you to do so, now by opening his cloak, now by planting himself in front of you like a bulwark, so forcefully that it would seem hugely impolite to ignore him. Now, if you've read any of the existing historiography on Italian sumptuary law, you might be a little surprised that I have so far focused mainly on men. Most of the literature either assumes or explicitly states that these were laws directed mainly or only against women. Where they mention men at all, there has been a presumption that men are being punished for dressing too femininely. In looking at the records of people breaking the Genoese laws, however, I was surprised to find that men outnumbered women. In terms of overall sumptuary offences, there are 289 men to 242 women. If we focus on offences concerning dress, however, the disparity becomes even more striking. 269 men to 99 women. In other words, there are almost three times as many men breaking the law on clothing as women. And for the most part, their offences do not seem to concern effeminate dress. The vast majority of them are for an outfit of black silk, whether taffeta, satin or velvet, ornamented with some sort of precious metal stitching, or with lace, as in this portrait of an anonymous Genoese nobleman by Van Dyck. Pairing the sumptuary records with literary sources, then, there seems to have been a particular form of vaunting, flaunting masculine dress in Genoa, which both the sumptuary magistrates and writers like Cebà found troublesome. While the historiography had led me to believe that the sumptuary records would be mainly populated with elite women, instead I found a large number of elite men. Perhaps equally surprisingly, though, it's not just elites that the laws provide insights into. There are around 30 mentions of artisans caught making a prohibited item. These artisan entries are often clustered together, and often in the summertime. For example, there are three tailors recorded on the 28th of June 1595. Geronimo Piola and Agostino Bollero, who were both working on garments in black taffeta, slashed and embroidered, and Master Battista, called Il Barbotto, who was making a lady's dress in two-coloured damask. Artisan offences, then, seem to be concentrated in the warmer months. And I would speculate that this pattern might suggest something about the physical setup of workshops. Perhaps the summer weather encouraged artisans to open up the front of their botteghe, making their activities more visible to the officers. Among artisans, too, there are repeat offenders. We have already encountered the wife of Giovannettino the cheesemaker, stitching the red silk shirt. 3 years after her original offence, she is recorded again, this time embroidering a black satin doublet. Artisans, too, do not appear to have been overly deterred by whatever punishment the sumptuary magistrates exacted. These entries are also a reminder of the reach of sumptuary law. Artisans working on luxurious clothes were affected by these laws just as much as those who would go on to wear them. Now, from everything I've shown you so far, you would be justified in thinking that people didn't pay much attention to sumptuary law, because obviously there are a great number of people breaking it. However, I found two contemporary textual sources which suggest that the laws did penetrate popular consciousness, whether or not people actually observed them. These take the form of a diary and a dialogue. The dialogue, by Cristoforo Zabata, is between six young Genoese noblewomen and is called, imaginatively, the Ragionamento di sei nobili fanciulle genovesi. The dialogue was first printed in 1583, interestingly, the same year that the major set of sumptuary provisions for women were promulgated. Now, this dialogue suggests that, far from being unaware of sumptuary law, in fact, complying with it caused some anxiety. One of the interlocutors is extremely concerned about being apprehended by the sumptuary magistrates for her dress, to the extent that she considers entering a convent to be free from such worries. The appropriately named Virginia longs for a simple religious life where I wouldn't have to fear being condemned by the sumptuary magistrates for having an underskirt that's longer than the dress on top. The diary was kept by Genoese patrician Giulio Pallavicino. He makes several mentions of official sumptuary proclamations, including on the 6th of September, and again this is 1583, a cry went out from the most handsome sumptuary office that women cannot take more than two servants with them when they go about in sedan chairs. They also made proclamations on dresses, robes, and collars. Now, the 6th of September 1583 was not a slow day for news. Bookending the sumptuary proclamation in the diary are two pretty exciting occurrences. Firstly, two galleys of the Duke of Savoy docked in the port, bringing with them an important state visitor. Secondly, the severed head of Fontana Buona the Bandit was brought into town. Now, I think the placement of the sumptuary announcement nestling between two such juicy stories is testament to the fact that people were very much aware of these laws, whether or not they actually followed them. And I think we also have to bear in mind the possibility that the records of the sumptuary offences are to an extent a gilded mirror whose reflection of dress is delightful but possibly deceptive. After all, there was no reason to note down the people complying with the laws, who, for all we know, might have been in the majority. To conclude, I started this paper by asking two questions. Did anyone pay any attention to the laws? And who were the main offenders against them? In answer to the first, I suggest that the laws did penetrate popular consciousness, even though large numbers of people broke them. As for the second, by contrast to studies that focus on elite female offenders, I have shown that in Genoa, the majority of the culprits were male, and that not all of the offenders were members of the elite. These clothes are dangerous objects of desire, nodes of conflict between the lawmakers who tried to ban them and the people who continued to make and wear them. Let us return again to the cheesemaker's wife. I would like to finish by highlighting a couple of things about her story. Firstly, she is a working-class woman, which is a reminder of the reach of sumptuary law. A focus on elite things need not necessarily mean a focus on elites. And this, incidentally, is part of what made sumptuary dress such an intractable problem. So many diverse groups of people were invested in the making and wearing of it. Secondly, both times she was caught, she was working on a male garment. I hope I have shown how men and artisans have been unjustly left out of the sumptuary story. While portraits like this may be more eye-catching to historians, it was men dressed like this that were causing the most trouble in Genoa, and artisans with no portraits who were making the troublesome clothes.